I'm Addict. I'm Stuart.
Hey, Stuart.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What an honor to be asked to share your experience, strength, and hope. So, this meeting, in case you don't know, the topic of this meeting is step three. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. It's done. Sorry about that. Did I turn it off? Got it. Thank you. Back to that. Step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. So with those two things in mind, let me share with you guys a little bit about myself, because I'm not a speaker, I'm a sharer. I share my experience, my strengths, and my hopes. And my experience is that my life, I started using at a very early age. I was about 11 years old, and I started with narcotics, yellow opium to be exact. And it progressed from there. I did many geographical cures. I lived all over the country. Everywhere I went, there I was. And ironically enough, and I'm from the northwest area of Baltimore, ironically enough, the end of my road, I was living not far from where we're standing right now, and I was being made willing to turn my will and my life over to a care of God that I had no understanding of. I grew up in a religious family. I didn't like religion. I thought that God was for those who couldn't handle life, and they needed a crutch. They needed something to support them in some way, shape, or form. And I came to that understanding because I sought out God, and I saw in all the major religions something that turned me off, and that was the self-righteous end, how they were all right. And I couldn't understand how every religion could be right and every other religion could be wrong. And I began my quest. And when I say that my journey started here, I'll tell you a real quick story. I lived here year-round. I worked in the summertime as many jobs as I could because the winter times were really scarce. I lived in a house in Ocean Pines, and Ocean Pines had just been built. It wasn't developed. 589 was a farm road. Nobody traveled it unless you were going to Ocean Pines or back to Delaware. Partying and getting high was acceptable in this community. And I worked. My day job, my year-round job, was at a hotel. I was the food and beverage inventory manager. I inventoried much of that food and beverage straight to my house. And my summer job was on the boardwalk, where I could be as crazy as I wanted to be and do whatever I wanted to do, and it was okay. And friends would always come to visit because they could stay at Stewart's house and there'd be a party. And one particular weekend, the party was hearty at Stewart's house, and I went to my day job one morning, and I went to my night job that night, and when I got to the night job, the boss said, "Stuart, you're too fucked up. You're no good to us tonight. Go home and come back tomorrow." And that was not uncommon. That was okay. It was perfectly acceptable. Back then, I weighed 130 pounds when I was coming out of the water soaking wet. I was not a big guy. And when I left there, the girl I was living with at the time and our next door neighbor looked at me and they said, "Well, you can't drive home." My next door neighbor was about this big, like this, and he took my keys from me. And when he wasn't looking, I hit him in the back of the head, which was enough to stun him just long enough for me to grab my keys, and I took off running. And I disappeared. I was scared for my life. Long and the short of it is, I eventually wound up in my truck, and I eventually wound up trying to make my way home, and I eventually wound up being found on the side of the road wrapped around a tree by three ambulance drivers. There happened to have been an ambulance convention in town, and these three guys were on their way home back to Delaware and just happened to be on the road I was on and just happened to find me. They got my heart beating and got me to the hospital in Salisbury, and I spent the next month in the hospital there. And that wasn't enough to get me clean. I went through some other things with that. When I got out of the hospital, the damage I had done, I had punctured my knee, put a hole through my knee, I had dislocated my hip out the rear, fractured my pelvis, crushed my other hip. And when you do that stuff, the blood supply to the hip dies, and you do one of two things. You either get a new hip or you don't walk again. And I didn't have health insurance. Nobody was paying that kind of money for a hip for me, so I was surrendered to the fact that I wasn't going to walk again. And somewhere during the course of my hospital stay, they started bringing machines to me instead of me to machines. And doctors started showing up that I hadn't seen and I didn't know, and I didn't know who they were. And what they wound up telling me was they didn't know what was going on, but the blood supply was beginning to regain to my hip, and they didn't know what it meant. But that they were monitoring it and that they were going to find out. And what it meant was that that there was a miracle. So I eventually got out of the hospital, and there were two places I could go to learn how to walk again. One was Baltimore, and one was down in Richmond, Virginia. And I had family in Baltimore. That's where I was from. So I called home, and I said, "You know, I got to come home. I got to come to learn how to walk again." And my parents said, "Well, we need to discuss it. We'll let you know." And, you know, it's a very important point, because when you've done enough damage in someone's life that they've got to discuss whether they're going to help you one more time is very pertinent. And it took 3 days before they called me back. And in those 3 days, I motherfucked them up one side and down the other. I didn't need them. I don't need you. To hell with you. You can't call me back. I went to my hotel job, where at the hotel job, I was not allowed to work without a doctor's note. And there was no doctor going to give me a note. And I convinced them to allow me to do some work. And they found a job for me. They had a grill out on the beach, and they said I could sit on the bench and flip burgers on the grill, and that would be my job. And anyhow, my parents called me back, and they said that they had discussed it, and they were going to allow me to come home, and there was going to be one condition, and that was that I not bring drugs into their house. And again, that piece of information was real important to me as I got clean, because I realized that they had given up that I might not use anymore. They had given up the hope. They just didn't want me bringing it into their house. And the truth is I couldn't even respect that. So anyhow, we'll move forward real quick. I moved back to their house. I wasn't using because they weren't taking me to COP, and my day consisted of going to therapy. Then my mother taught an exercise class in a pool at a local community center, and I went there and swam with a kickboard to help my legs. And then I would go home and pass out from exhaustion, and Mom would make dinner, and I'd eat dinner, and I'd pass out again, and I'd do it all over again. And what happened was that eventually I began to be able to get out on my own. And when I got out on my own, I wound up where I wound up. And I understand that today. I understand that I used, because I was so uncomfortable in my own skin, that I would go to where I was comfortable. And where I was comfortable, I was involved in a music scene for a long time. I knew a lot of local musicians. I knew that kind of stuff. And, you know, I went to where I was comfortable. It didn't matter what I wanted to do. That's where I had to go. And when I went to where I was comfortable, I did what I was comfortable doing. And I wound up using. And as soon as I wound up using, my life began to go downhill again fast. And I didn't even see it until, you know, in a very quick period of time, you know, arrests and, you know, car wrecks and all that stuff again. And I wound up in Narcotics Anonymous. Doesn't matter how I got here, just like the rest of us. Somebody prayed me in here. And I wound up in Narcotics Anonymous. It was the summer of 1982, and I heard the message, and I got the hope. And I came in, and I did nothing I was told to do. I came in late, you know, because I was on crutches and couldn't walk, and I was different from you guys. I left early because I was afraid of you guys. And I didn't do anything. And what happened was, obviously, I used again. And on December 18th, 1982, it was my birthday, and I decided I was going to get clean. That was going to be my birthday present. And it was a Saturday night, and I went to a meeting in Catonsville at the Epic House. And, you know, I walked in there, and I'm going to get clean. And I didn't tell anybody it was my birthday. Nobody. And I thought all of you should be wishing me happy birthday and taking me out and doing things for me. And the meeting was over, and I felt all alone again. And I left. You know, I didn't tell anybody nothing. And I went downtown to where I was comfortable, and my friend's band was playing at a place called Gerard's, if anybody remembers that when it was still there. And the green room was up on the third floor. It was a big closet. And I went there, and I told everybody it was my birthday. And everybody was wishing me happy birthday. And, hey, have a little of this. No, I'm not doing that today. It's my birthday. I'm gonna stop. Somebody else would say, hey, have a little of this. And eventually I was in a chase from a drug dealer that we ripped off, driving down a one-way street the wrong way at about 70 miles an hour in Baltimore City. Made our way to my friend's house in Columbia. It was me, him, and some girl he picked up. He was doing what he was doing with the girl, and I had my own girlfriend. And a week later, I came down, and Christmas Eve, I went into a marathon meeting back at Epic House. And for the first time since I'd been coming here, I raised my hand. And I said, my name's Stuart, and don't think I can stay clean tonight. And that's my clean date. The third step talks about making a decision. And it's a very specific decision. And it is specific in the fact that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of a God as of our understanding. And I hear it all the time. People say, well, you don't have to know anything. All you got to know is you're not him. And I say, bullshit. Okay? That didn't work for me. My understanding of a God was not good. Okay? And I had to have an understanding of a God before I could follow that direction. If you take a child and you turn the child over to the care of a babysitter, the child is going to accept guidance from the babysitter. And the child is going to understand if the babysitter says, no, don't put your hand in the fire, and grabs the hand and pulls it away, There's an understanding there. I had no understanding of a God. I had to find an understanding of a God. And I had to write down attributes of a power greater than myself. And I had to search for this. I didn't know anything about this. I had to ask people about their God. And I came to a definitive view of my own God. I came to understand that my God was loving. I mean, come on, I had lived through all the stuff I just shared with you. My God was patient. I mean, you know, I was 25 when I got here, and I worked hard, you know. My God was understanding, you know. And as I came up with these parameters of who my God was, I began to be able to hear my God speak. Because if I don't know that my God is patient when I'm being an impatient jerk, how am I going to hear God say, "Stuart, man, you need to chill out a little. You need to have a little patience." How am I going to hear my God say, "You need to have a little understanding. You know, maybe that person's having a hard day." So once I established who my God was, I found out the man that I wanted to be, you know, because I wanted to be loving, patient, understanding, committed, on and on and on. So in working my third step, I began to understand that if I wanted all of these things for me, then I was going to need to be very open to hear what God was saying. One of the things God told me was that if I had the desire to be here, then I had every right to do everything there was to stay here. You know, in the third tradition, it talks about the only desire for membership. It talks about the only requirement for membership is a desire to be here. That tells me that I got to stay out of your business. I don't know why you're here. You know, if you're here, I have to assume that you have a desire. When I got here, I had a desire and didn't know it. You know, I came into my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I didn't know what I received that day. You know, it wasn't until a long time later that I understood that I received hope. You know, when I saw a guy up here, and he was clean, and he was smiling, and he was talking to people after the meeting, I wanted that. I couldn't talk to y'all when I got here. I was so uncomfortable, I couldn't say anything to you. I felt so less than. I couldn't come up and talk to you. And when you talked to me, I couldn't look at you. I don't think I looked someone in the eye for the first 2 years. I couldn't do it. So, what is a requirement? Well, a requirement tells me that if I have a desire to be a member, that there are things I must do. There are things I must do. You know, you hear a grateful addict will not use. Well, what does that mean? Okay. Hi, I'm grateful. You know, I can tell you how grateful I am till the cows come home. But the reality is here's what I do. When I walked into that meeting, raised my hand, said, "My name is Stuart, and I don't think I can do it." And these guys I don't know, came up to me and took me in. They said, "Hey, we're going to another marathon meeting down in D.C. tonight. Do you want to go?" My head said, "Fuck no." My mouth said, "Okay." I don't even know these guys. I get in a car with them. We're driving to D.C. Where the hell am I going? I get into a meeting. I grew up, you know, when I was raised in the 60s, in the early 70s, the country was in a totally different place. I had an uncle who I talk about a lot. My uncle was like, he was the shit. He was who I wanted to be. He raced cars. He had motorcycles. He was a black belt in karate. He was the shit. My grandfather owned a bar. We can say anything we want about my grandfather. My grandfather was a bookie who owned a bar. That's what they did back then. He made book. And my grandfather got killed in that bar. They say he was cleaning his gun. He wasn't cleaning his gun. He knew guns like anybody knew guns. He was murdered. We know that. My father and my uncle took over the bar so that my grandmother would have money. 60s were happening. The race riots were going on. Black guy came in, junkie, one of us, robbed the bar. My uncle gave him all the money. Turns around, goes to the door, turns back around, shoots my uncle in the throat and kills him. I did not have a good understanding of a God when I got here. I did not come in here loving. I came in here with a lot of garbage, a lot of prejudices, a lot of skills that I learned to survive my own emotions. So, in coming here in 1982, there weren't many people. You couldn't pick and choose who was going to help you stay clean. And you couldn't pick and choose who you were going to help stay clean. And there was a responsibility that went with staying clean because those guys were there for me when I finally raised my hand. And that responsibility doesn't go away in time. That responsibility gets greater in time as far as I'm concerned. And if I am grateful that those guys were there, I don't need to tell you shit. I need to show up. I got clean in 1982. You do the math. It's 26 and a half years. I still go to meetings all the time. All the time. We go on vacation. I don't know about people that go on vacation and don't go to meetings. We went on our honeymoon. My wife and I got married in recovery. The best thing that's ever happened to me. We flew to Phoenix, Arizona, where we picked up a motorcycle. And we took off. That was our honeymoon. First thing we did was we went to a meeting in Phoenix. And we go to a meeting in Phoenix, and we introduce ourselves. And we said, after the meeting, I said, we want some Mexican food. Where can we go for some good Mexican food? And they sent us to some Chili's or something, you know, chain food. And we said, no. We want real stuff. Where would you go? And all of a sudden, they said, the Marylanders want Mexican party at Los Compadres, and we had a party. So we told them our trip. We told them what we were doing. 8 days later, we're going all through the state. We wind up in Flagstaff, Arizona. We pull up to a meeting. Two strangers on a Harley, and the people walk up to us and say, you must be the Marylanders. We've been waiting for you. That's what happens here, you know. And that's part of the requirement for membership. That goes with the requirement for membership. You know, you got a desire to stay clean. That's all it takes. Nobody can tell you to get out of here. Okay, but what I'm here to tell you is if you want to stay here, there are responsibilities that go with that. There are things you must do. They say there's no musts around here. Well, okay. I say it all the time. The only thing you got to do is just don't use. My wife used to say, oh, no, you got to do this. You got to get a sponsor. You got to do this. You got to do that. I say, no, you don't. All you got to do is don't use. Just don't use. Don't put it in you. No matter what, do not use. If you do not use, no matter what, eventually, even you will get sick of you and you will do something else. So I really honor the fact that this convention has put these things together, the steps and traditions, you know, and has asked us to share those. My experience is just what I've shared. You know, my experience is that I had to find a God of my understanding. I had to define that. It had to be mine. You know, I had to know what it was. It wasn't okay to just know it wasn't me. I mean, I understand for some people that's a start, okay? But it wasn't okay. I had to define the God of my understanding so that I could hear that God speak to me, so that I could have a direction and where I wanted to go. You know, I had to understand that, you know, it was okay for you to be here just as much as it was okay for me to be here. If you had a desire to be here, that was okay. You know, it told me, doesn't care what color you are, doesn't care what religion you are, doesn't care what sexual preference you are, none of that matters. You know, and I understood that from the get-go. There weren't enough people. It was hard for me. It was hard for me. You know, if you were black, you killed my uncle. That's all it was. If you were, it doesn't matter. If you were anything, it was what was in the back of my head, you know. And if you wanted to stay clean and called me up and said, hey, I need a ride to a meeting, and I got a ride, it was it. You know, when I got clean, the first year I was clean, we had a blizzard in Baltimore, and I had access to a four-wheel drive truck that I had gotten again. And in the blizzard, I'm riding around down near Mondawmin Mall, picking up a newcomer in a four-wheel drive truck with 33-inch tires. This guy gets in the truck, and this crazy white boy is driving, and we're not on the road because the median strip was in the way. And with four-wheel drive and a blizzard, it didn't matter where you drove. And we went and had a meeting, and then we went to somebody's house. And at this point in time, I was managing a video store down the street from where my friend lived, and I had the keys. So we went to the video store and got video recorders and movies. And we spent the next 2 days having a meeting in his house. This is what we did. You know, there was responsibility to stay clean. You have to do certain things if you're going to stay here. You know, I love Narcotics Anonymous. I love this convention, been coming since its inception. 23 years since, as a region, we decided to have a convention, which was a resentment out of not getting this East Coast as soon as we wanted it. Just my opinion. And then another resentment happened, and the Free State region happened. And anyhow, I'm done. You know, I absolutely love the fact that Narcotics Anonymous offered me an opportunity to have a life that is absolutely wilder than I only dreamed about. And I absolutely know that if I am to stay here, I'm to show up for the guy coming behind me. I mean, that's all there is to it, you know. I absolutely know that it is my responsibility to show up at my home group and to show up early, to welcome the newcomer, to set the chairs up, to make sure the coffee's ready, to make sure that it's right, because nobody can make it right like me. You know, to make sure that cigarette butts are cleaned up when I don't smoke and can't stand it. You know, to make sure that the image of Narcotics Anonymous at the church where my home group is a good image. You know, and to make this a welcome place for you when you walk in the door. You know, to share with you what I believe is most important, so hopefully you might share it with someone else. You know, when they told me that an addict, any addict, could get clean, I did. Lose the desire to use, took some time, but I'm one of those people that did. And find a new way to live. I'm here to tell you, my life is better than it's ever been. You know, it's taken me a long time to share a lot of the stuff that happened that got me here from this town. But I am free to be in this town today. I'm free from my own bondage, of my own fears from the things that I did in this town. And it's all as a result of Narcotics Anonymous. So with that, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Richie, who's going to share next, and have a great rest of the convention.
Come on, y'all. All right, our second speaker is going to be Rich.
I'm an addict. My name is Richie. I'd like to thank God for allowing me to be here. Give me another opportunity of life. I'd like to thank the Chesapeake Potomac region for recognizing something in me, the fact that I have done some work. Because this ain't like no just random topic where you could just share this. This is about that you've had to do some work. Any literature. I want to thank my woman for having the courage to come and hear me share, because it's been a few years since she's been able to do that based on some of the harm that I've caused. And some of you know me, you've known me for years, and you know when I have an opportunity to do this, I'm going to get to the exact nature of my wrongs, and a lot of times she's in those wrongs. So I respect that somebody had enough courage to be able to separate themselves from continuing to be abused while I work through my issues here with y'all. Because somebody's in bondage that needs to hear the way out. And thank God I've had the courage to come here and tell it exactly how it is so you can help me right at my level of pain. See, because I try to convince you I'm on a 132nd Street with my illness, and I'm really down here at 40th Street, you're going to be looking to help me up there. And so I'm not going to get my real help because I'm going to be caught in ego and image time based on wanting to live down to your opinion of me rather than up to my God-given potential. So I want to be free, and freedom is not being controlled by the things that used to control me, so that means I got to take a risk. And it says sharing can be risky, but not sharing can be deadly. So I trust God. He's gotten me this far. It's been a painful road because I always have the ability to make decisions without consulting him first. So I kind of wanted to do it a little different. I wanted to start with the traditions because I believe that you have to have a desire before you're really ready to display any level of willingness. There has to be a spark. And the reason that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using is because we come in here so fucked up, man, that if there was any other requirement, we probably wouldn't be able to meet it. Well, let me just tell you how it happened for me, because I'm not a teacher or a preacher or any spokesperson that says that our message is all we have to give. So let me just tell y'all how good God has been to me, and I'm going to tie it to the topic. I drank methadone for 3 years. My mother, because there was no car. I'll give you a couple different reference points in my story. So, you know, because I'll go from the initial desire to some reference points in my story. But she used to take me down. The clinic opened at 5:30 in the morning. She had to be to work by 7. So we drove over an hour, half hour, 45 minutes down, half hour, because I got kicked out of all the ones that were close because I used to always try to turn in somebody else's urine so I could get a take home so I could sell it at Lexington Market so I could shoot dope. So I would sleep most of the day because if you're anything like me, you manipulate. I don't, you know, so I probably could have got away with maybe 80 milligrams and been well, but I needed more. So I would sleep half the day. When I woke up, I would be so medicated, I would go out and try to find something to steal in my mother's neighborhood because, you know, that she lived in the county, so there was lawnmowers. People were a little careless back then. It ain't quite, we've fucked shit up now. But what happened was that I would steal, and then I would find a way to get to a pawn shop, and then I would smoke crack, and then I would smoke crack so much that the methadone would wear off, so then I would be shooting dope, and by this time it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning, and the only shop that would be open would be either Park Heights or Pennsylvania Avenue. And even though I was a dope fiend, I was kind of snobby. I only liked to shoot raw dope, so I would have to go up into real treacherous areas. And as a direct result of me having to conform to be able to cop in those areas, my identity got a little bit confused. I'm just telling you, they used to say shit like, you were a black man trapped in a white man's body. And because I needed to do what I needed to do, I bought into that. So then when I got here, I wasn't always a recovering addict. I was also a recovering Wigro. This is all tied into the third tradition because a lot of times our behaviors can become so offensive that we can actually push our help away. But the third tradition ensures that we don't do that. Anybody who musters up enough courage to make it through the doors deserves the right to recover, and we're supposed to do everything we can to nurture and encourage and fan the flame of desire. It says not dampen it. So you guys worked with me. And I just want you to know where I came from, just in case, you know, because sometimes it get caught up. We only got 30 minutes, so you got to start sometimes at the middle of the road. But the middle of the road ain't what keeps me clean. It's the end of the road. I can get in touch with the true desperation that I got to the door with. And that desperation ties into the third step because it's only when you suffer does God have your undivided attention. It's only at that point that you become willing to do whatever it is that he's requesting of you. So look, that's what got me here. The neat part was that I stole something. I stole the wrong thing. It was time. And I ended up in jail. I ended up in jail with 80 milligram methadone habit, smoking crack. After I would shoot dope, then I would drink alcohol to try to come down from the crack. I mean, I was just all over the place. Any drug, any combination, anything I could get to not feel me and the reality, try to sedate the reality of what my life had become, I would do that. So they threw me in jail. And guess what? When I got to that jail cell and I knew the detox process was coming. I knew it was coming. I said, God, please don't ever let me have to use again. And from that point, I had become a member of Narcotics Anonymous. See, I don't know if you understand that, but it's when you cry out that cry from the inside that you never want to use again. You ain't never had to been to an NA meeting to be a member. It's when you have that desire initially. Now, we know that based in the literature and all that, in order to stay, you got to do some work. So then it says that the desire initially has to be backed up with a commitment. So they did something crazy one day. They let my ass out of jail. But they ain't have no choice because I had a job to do and I was working for God. And I didn't know that it was going to get to this point. But the thing is that I am the message. What he has done in my life and where I'm at now and where I'm headed, that I have a life with purpose, aim, and direction. that I don't do some of the things that I used to do. I'm in touch with the fact that my disease is only arrested. It can and will make bail, and it does that. It does that, but if I have the ability to be honest about what's going on with me, I can get to a reference point in my healing. Stop blaming everybody else for the mess that I made in my life. So that was, you know, that was the initial. That was the initial. But see, I'm kind of like so driven by the need to be accepted that what happened was that I took on a belief system in the streets and I brought that belief system with me to Narcotics Anonymous. And that belief system was that, you know, because I admired my, you know, this disease will take all your champions and your heroes and they'll make it something else. You know, when I used to want to be an athlete, then I just wanted to be a dope dealer because it looked like that they were having fun. What I really know was that you didn't have to experience any pain is what I thought from being a dope dealer because you could run off the power, the illusion of status and control. And anytime anybody got too close to that person that I really thought if you got to know you would hate them the way that I hated myself, I could just swap you out. Because I would deal with people that whose self-esteem was lower than mine, that all they wanted was some money, a hairdo, you know, maybe a bill paid or something here and there. And that gave me the illusion that I was in control. So when I got to Narcotics Anonymous, when they released me from jail, for the first 3 years, I sold drugs. And I ain't going to say that I didn't know another way. I just was unwilling to wait on God. That's that selective surrender that occurs here. You know, some things, when I can see tangible evidence of how they're working out, I'll be willing to surrender that to God quick. But it's the stuff that I can't see how he's working. The intangible is the stuff that I take my will back and try to force it. So what happened is that it becomes the attraction, the attractive force in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. As it talks about it, I'll just give you this because I brought it, so I might as well use it. It says, Tradition 3 asked us to set aside our self-righteousness. See, so based in fear, I would judge your shortcomings to try to make myself seem better than, because I really didn't want to get into touch with the level of pain that it was going to take to be able to get to some healing. So I would shoot jumpers from the perimeter about you because I wasn't willing to go down in the paint and box it out and get to the truth about me. So what happened was that y'all had one thing that money couldn't buy, and that was peace. And I wanted it so bad, but I didn't know how to surrender to go the route to get it. So I just tried to use every woman that I could. I just tried to buy every pair of tennis shoes that I could. I just tried to buy the hat to match. Then I had every latest Nextel because that was when the bleep bleeps came out. And I was like the first one to have them. And then I had to get every model after that because I had to keep up with the Joneses. I had to look a certain way for you, my vision that you saw that I was had arrived. Maybe if I had all these things and I looked like success, maybe you wouldn't ask me how I really felt. So it was basically a way that I would keep the stiff arm on you because I didn't know that I was enough. I didn't know that I measured up, and I damn sure wasn't willing to talk about all those fears, doubts, and insecurities. So I was being driven and didn't know it. So what happens is all I did was just keep coming back. So I guess for the first 3 years, I had about a half a first step. And that's where you just surrender to the chemical, you know. It's the second surrender in the first step. It'll get you to the real surrender of the third step after you surrender to the new way of life. Then you got to surrender to doing the next right thing regardless of how you feel about it. So let me just say a couple more things about Tradition 3, then I'll just transfer right on over. I'm going back and forth, but I have had a couple people that have been in my life lately that have been doing some unexplainable shit. Right? And they've sought refuge in me because I've had to tell my story and all the pain that I've caused and the harm that I've caused in people's life so that they know they can confide in me because I keep it real. I've done everything you can imagine in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous except use. So that's the message. As long as you keep coming back and you don't put one in you, at some point you'll change in spite of yourself. So I'm just saying that I had to, after all the stuff and then becoming willing to change, it's 5 years later. I've been through the steps 2 times now with a sponsor in 5 years, and I'm here at a convention sharing with you how good God has been to me. So I had to come to the meetings, and I had to also be able to be willing to talk about what was exactly going on in my life and how my behaviors and the manifestations of this disease had taken a foothold in my life and were taking me where they wanted me to go without fear of reprisal or judgment from the group, because I knew that I needed to come here and be able to heal. I needed somebody to show me how to get out, and there was no way that I could share my way out of something that I had behaved myself into. So somebody had to take me and walk with me. And that was like the trust piece, where the faith that it could happen transferred into the trust, because I knew that this was all I had. And I had seen some of you who lived a whole lot better than you shared. And that was the real message, because I could stand here and say all kinds of fabulous shit and make a stone weep, and then as soon as I hit that door, I'll be a walking contradiction of all the shit that I just said. And the third tradition allows us to not have to get caught up in that, because what I need to understand is that them behaviors are just a manifestation of a level of self-hatred that I'm experiencing. That's what it says. And it says humility reminds us that we aren't God. We need to help each other with encouragement, not criticism or rejection. Our awareness of our own shortcomings, exercised in humility, helps us remember this. So then the self-acceptance, once you know you do that too when nobody's looking, or you have the ability to just because you haven't done it yet, the self-acceptance that accompanies humility makes us reluctant to judge others harshly. It don't mean I ain't going to take a look at you and say something. It just says I better get back in my lane quick. You ain't got the right to be beating nobody with their behaviors. You know, when they become beaten, they'll become willing, the same way it happened for you. So for real, what you need to do is just show them some love. And that's uncomfortable, because that means that I have to be willing to jump in their pain with them. Now, we say we got a selfless service position here, and it's gratitude and action and all that. But a lot of times we give them a hug and say, it'll be all right. Really? It'll be all right? So it just is my responsibility to be extra kind to people, because everybody's struggling with something and you really don't know what it is. So if you can't love them right at their point of need, you might just need to pass them on to somebody who can. Because everybody's not, can't handle every service position in Narcotics Anonymous. You're just not built for that. Everybody's not an NA speaker. We need coffee makers too. So my buddy has been dealing with something. And I've found myself judging his behaviors, and that's not my position. I really don't have any experience in the area that he's in, because I've taken a different self-righteous approach, and it says we need to lay that down right here. I got a buddy of mine that I've respected for years here, and I just made the decision that he's lost his fucking mind. Because I do, there's certain, I got certain, let's call them hood beliefs that I came up with. And one thing we don't do is we, and I know you're going to see some unexplainable shit here. I mean, this is Welcome to Narcotics Anonymous, right, George? This is the greatest show on earth. But if you know that I'm fucking with one woman, and I've been with one woman for years, and then we're having some tough times, you don't try to go fuck that woman. You understand? Like, there's just an unwritten code that I live by, but guess what? Everybody don't live by that code. And what happened was that it says the internal strife cripples the fellowship. So what happened was, me judging his behaviors, I've been separating myself from him. Now, his information is fabulous, but his application's been lacking. So now I'm cutting off my help one at a time, because I've become self-righteous in judging what they're doing, instead of just giving them an application of some acceptance and some love and some understanding. So, because I can see it oh so well of how he's being driven, because guess what? He's reminding me of me. I just did it a little different. So there's how I'm looking at the differences and not the similarities, and all of a sudden I'm caught up in the ties that tear us apart instead of the ones that bind us together. But thank God for the ability to see myself and how I'm doing it. Because what happens now is that I learn how to surrender a little bit more quickly, quietly, and completely as a result of the step work and a relationship with God. So now. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want me to talk about that? You think I should? All right, yeah, because it all applies. And it's this is the beginning of my true surrender, third step. But sometimes some things have to happen in your life for you to realize that you got a hole in your third step. Because let go and let God. How you do that? The hardest part of holding on is letting go. And anything I like, when it leaves, it's dinged up. Oh, yeah, it's dinged up. There's dents, there's claw marks, there's some Nah. Because what that's going to happen is if something leaves me before I'm ready for it to go, somehow my self-centeredness attaches that to my low self-worth, and that means that there's something wrong with me. And you leaving is a representation of how fucked up I am. So we could be miserable. Just don't leave me. That ain't now. But we had to go through that. Because it's funny, when you swear, you know what you're doing. The literature says, I don't know how to live with or without drugs, but I'm going to come in here and front my ass off. Because I don't want to be exposed to just exactly how immature and inexperienced I am. But you know the thing about immature people, they're masters of the alibi. And that's been my story. You know what I mean? Conflicted, disorganized, you know. My life's been a maze of broken promises and unfinished business. You know what I'm saying? You know, good intentions never materialize. So I spent my life exploring endless possibilities and then doing nothing. Because it's your fault. Because I'm a spoiled brat and I've never had to really do a whole lot of nothing. You know, because I'm my mother's only child. My father left way early and I learned how to be the only man in her life. And God damn it, I was not going to allow anybody else to have that role. Because then I was going to be forced to do some work. I ain't lying. This is step work gave me that clarity. I didn't know that I was doing all that. That I beat up her boyfriend sometimes and stole his wallet and did all kinds of insane shit to make his. I mean, I had to do it, but I mean. So, it says that we are making a simple decision to change direction. Stop rebelling at the natural and logical flow of events in our lives. Stop wearing ourselves out trying to make everything happen as if we were in charge of the world. We're accepting that a power greater than ourselves will do a better job of caring for our will in our lives than we have. And that's evident because people that stab themselves with needles couldn't possibly love themselves. But see, what happens is that then once the drugs leave, it becomes tricky how I'm really self-destructing with other manifestations of a behavior because I can make it look like it's a good time. And I can convince some of you all who are just equally as immature as me spiritually who will support me in my self-destruction. And then we'll form our own committee. And the moment somebody confronts that denial in our committee, we got a motherfucking problem. Oh, yeah. So I had to get to a place where no matter what happened, I had to believe that my God was big enough to fix anything. You know, and then with that bit of faith, I had to let him. And that's scary because I come from the only thing that I can trust is the things that I can touch, taste, see, and feel. And I've been so damaged in my relationships because my father left. Then the first woman I ever thought I loved slept with my homeboy. And then I just was set out on a path of self-destruction from that point. I was going to do you before you ever got a chance to do me. And anytime anything seemed halfway healthy, I couldn't handle that responsibility because I had to sabotage it because I was being controlled by a negative sense of self. So I didn't even have a choice. Just giving you little pieces along the way, you know what I mean? Found somebody God presented when it was actually time for me to change. He put somebody in my life that said, I love you and I know that's not who you are. And I believe that we can work this out if you give me some time. See, because I had evidence that I would do stuff, pretty much force you to leave, because I didn't know how to say, this is enough. Because what happened was it would tap into the little boy who got abandoned. So that's why I would stay in unhealthy relationships, because I didn't want to be confronted by that same feeling that I wasn't enough. And that's why he left, because he didn't love you. You weren't a good son. And all that was a lie. But the disease has to keep you trapped in the lie in order to be able to control you with all them self-destructive behaviors. And the third step is about being willing to do something completely different and do the next right thing for the next right reason in spite of how you feel. So I did something crazy. I always do something crazy. That's what I do. The pendulum swing on the things that I do crazy have gotten a little bit more narrow in their range of the way that it swings. Because when you hate yourself, there is no limit to the things you'll do in the process of self-destruction. There's no limit. So how much time I got? Because I'm going to get into this. I got 5 minutes? Mitch. That's my buddy. Mitch is great. All right. People who trust God normally don't still own handguns. All right? That's a reservation. Just want to let you know that. And then what happens is your ego is attached to that gun, because I'm the baddest man on the planet when I got a gun in my hand. All right? We're going to do it now, and then we're going to leave, because we're going to set this motherfucker off, and we're going to celebrate recovery today. But I haven't really told this story yet. What happened was I moved into we're going to call it a seedy neighborhood. I mean, it's the hood, man. It was the hood. You know, I'm caught up. You know, black man trapped in a white man's body. I copped at 3 in the morning on Pennsylvania Avenue on Belvedere. You know, they knew not to fuck with me. I done put in enough work in my using to let them know that motherfucking white boy is out of his mind. Don't fuck with him. Matter of fact, we like your motherfucking crazy ass. So that fed my ego. Whenever I went anywhere in Baltimore City, they knew me. So what happened was I moved into this neighborhood carrying the residue of my past, running off of ego, you say easing God out, that they knew not to fuck with me. That's what I'm thinking. And then, you know, so what happens is one night, it was obvious that they didn't get the message. I ain't lying. I'm talking about being driven, man, when, damn, this thing is powerful. I had some friends, some white friends, leave my house at 11 o'clock, 11 something at night. And when they left my house, some boys from the neighborhood, see, now I had to go back to the hood mentality. What happened is there was a couple yo boys that lived across the street on the porch. They would always hang out. It'd be 5 or 10 of them. You know, they were clocking us. Basically, they were clocking us. And I know this because I know the behavior, because I come from that way of life. So it wasn't hard to revert, especially when it was only sitting right there anyway. It wasn't hard to go back and get that thing. So they leave. Dude comes from behind the bushes, sticks him up, got the bandana on his face. What happens is I go to a place of untreated addiction. Untreated. Because what happened was when I was using, I got stuck up. that fight or flight kicked in. You ain't taking my shit, motherfucker. And he shot me. After we fought over the gun and bullets went through my legs and under my armpit, he shot me through my hand because I was trying to take the gun from him. So what happened was I didn't know that traumatization still was lingering deep in my spirit. And the reason I still possessed the handgun was because just in case anybody ever tried to do me that way again, it was going to go a whole lot different. See, this is the work. This is after. After you destroy your life without the use of a chemical with the behaviors, then you can get a new reality of where you're really at in your recovery. You stop sharing where you want them to think you are, and you start sharing where the hell you really are. They went out, the stick-up began, and I ran upstairs, put the clip in, lifted the window, and waited. And I waited. I waited patiently. My heart was beating. I was excited. You know, it was on. It was on. This was justified. He still had the gun on him, so I had to wait because I didn't want to bust him, and then he shoot them by accident. Only thing was, I don't know if any of y'all are going to understand this, but I had him dead to rights, and I laid it on the windowsill, and I was steady, and I was working on my breathing. Oh, yeah. I was, hey. And something said, you can't kill him. The old way of life, he'd had to go. That's the belief system. That's just the way it goes. And this one say, oh, I don't want to lose favor with God. But that thing that was driving me said he's got to pay a penalty for what he's doing. He can't fuck with us like that. Because the next one will be a home invasion if we let this go. So instead of shooting high, I said, all right, shoot him in the leg, shoot him in the leg, shoot him in the leg. Forgot about the fact that, you know, I suffer from fantasy. I became a character in my own movie. I shit you not, I'm telling you, this is real life. We got guns and bullets and people's lives are at stake. And as soon as he took the gun off him and let him go, I said, check this out, bitch. Boom. Oh, my God. He went behind the car, and the next crazy shit happened. He got behind the car and started shooting back. Hold on, you gotta hear this. Then the ego said, oh, motherfucker, it's on now, right? But it was still a conflict in my spirit because he was behind Miss Linda's car. And you can't go tearing into Miss Linda's car. Because she's a good woman. She works hard every day. This is going on in the middle of a gunfight. Yo, can I make this shit up? So I had him pinned down behind the car. He's shooting. I get angry. Motherfucker. But I can't shoot because he's behind Miss Linda's car. Then he makes a dash for this big tree across the street. Said, all right, the tree is acceptable. There's grand, you know, fuck you. So, and he's reaching around the tree like just fucking. Next thing you know, he tears ass up the street. But he runs by the new car I just bought Teresa. So I can't, fuck! So we had to move. Oh, you need to understand that whole moving piece hurt worse than anything else. Because I felt like a bitch. Because I wanted to go to my mother's house and get this pistol grip pump that I got for situations like this. And then something happened. My woman said, you're out of your fucking mind. You're going to stay here and live down to these non-existent virtues if you want to, but I'm out of here. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Don't you know this is how it's got to go down? We got to handle this. So I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't even see at the fact of how God is good, God has been to me. None of them, I didn't think about ricocheting and all the bricks, and they could have, the street, and they could have went anywhere, and innocent people that were sleeping in their homes, and babies, and I could have got shot again. I mean, none of that was evident. And somebody that I loved more than I love myself said, we can't do this. We got to go. And then I had to talk about it because I was so messed up by being able to go that far out of my mind with almost 8 years clean. This wasn't 6 years ago. This wasn't even 6 months ago. So I'm still trying to get in touch with how far gone I really am from reality and how much I really don't trust God the way that I would like to say I do. So that all ties together, because what happened is that I still have to trust that the people are going to understand that when I bring that kind of stuff to the meeting, they're not going to judge my behaviors. They're going to look at the level of illness, understand that I have a fatal condition, and that I need help. So that's how, you know, you find out those that judge don't matter and those that matter don't judge. And that's why you will just keep continuing to have new people in your support network, because everybody going to be able to be equipped to support you right at your level of need. So that teaches me, because I've been so crazy in my own life, to just be able to love everybody right where they're at, because I know how painful it is to be me. So it gives me an opportunity to know how painful it must be to be you. So before Mitch embarrasses me, I would like to thank y'all for believing in me and allowing me to share.